Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards?
Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to Streets Ahead, a podcast dedicated to active travel, livable streets, and people-focused urban design. I'm Ned Bolting.
I'm Adam Tranter.
And I'm Laura Laker.
And welcome to this, our 9th episode. Now, this week, by popular demand, we are leaving London, and a lot of you will be sighing with relief at that. In fact, we're going to the West Midlands, figuratively, not literally, except for Adam, who is literally in the West Midlands and always likes to, quite rightly, to remind us so. But joining us today is Councillor Wasim Zaffer, the Cabinet Member for Transport and the Environment at Birmingham City Council. Now, Wasim, can you start by telling us about your particular cycling journey? What got you into the idea of active travel?
The cycling journey that I've been part of is quite interesting. For the first 37 years of my life, I'd never been on a bike. So up until 2 years ago, I'd never been on a bike. And for an obese type 2 diabetic, you can understand the challenges that my life's had. And I've been type 2 diabetic since the age of 25. And my story is quite common for many South Asian kids because cycling generally is a white middle class hobby or a sport, however you wish to call it. And so 2 years ago, very soon after, I was appointed to the role of Cabinet Member for Transport and started talking about walking and cycling as a real option against private car. I took that very scary journey to learn how to ride a bike, and I did it in a very public way on social media with the help of Big Birmingham Bikes. And honestly, I was so nervous. It was unbelievable. But the buzz of cycling in Handsworth Park, my local park, within minutes of being on the bike for the first time, was I quite clearly realized I missed something quite huge. But so for me, it's there's a lot of people that talk about commuter journeys by cycling. There's people that talk about cycling as a hobby. I think cycling is around reversing health inequalities and tackling some of those real issues that exist in our communities. And my ward of Lascelles, where I'm a councillor, where I went to school, I've grown up, has the lowest male life expectancy in the city. It's got major, major health challenges, as have many areas in Birmingham and inner city areas across the country. So I think cycling can be used to tackle some of those real health issues that exist in our communities.
Wasim, my experience of cycling in Birmingham is limited, I have to say, but I think off the top of my head, the last time I did it was about maybe 5 or 6 years ago when I was doing, and I did it for a couple of successive years, actually. I was doing a job in Redditch, just south of Birmingham. And in order to do that, I live in London. Mm-hmm. I took my bike up to Birmingham New Street Station and cycled from Birmingham down to Redditch, spent the night there actually and cycled back the next day, which is, I can't remember how many miles, it's a few miles, isn't it? And I was actually really struck by how good, relatively good, that particular cycle route was and how safe it was, but how extraordinarily underused it was. I seem to be the only person doing it. This is sort of 5 or 6 years ago. And it did strike me at the time that there's Birmingham has a lot of potential in that it's not terribly hilly, unlike Sheffield or a lot of the Yorkshire conurbations or Newcastle. And it's the right kind of size to really embrace a cycling revolution. And it struck me with some of the wide roads as well that this was eminently feasible. If I came back tomorrow to do that journey or indeed cycle around Birmingham, what would I see? How will it have changed, do you think?
So Ned, one of the key things you'll see is the segregated cycle lane from the city centre that will take you, I think, 3 or 4 kilometres down the A38. So probably half your journey to Redditch will be through segregated cycle lanes. And if you came in August, hopefully you'll get a pop-up cycle lane which enhances and that and takes it further afield. I think in Birmingham, a city which is classified as one of the motor cities in the UK, the love for private car is there. And unfortunately, despite having policy which for a number of years has looked to take space away from private car for walking, cycling and public transport, we've actually not implemented it. And we've as decision makers, we've been quite scared in a way to take on motorists. And all our decisions, whether you go back to the 70s or even before then, and the concrete collar in Birmingham have been focused around prioritizing private car over people. It's not over over walking or cycling or public transport. For me, it's over people and people's life chances, because this is what this really is about. So moving forward, you know, we've got quite a radical plan. We had the draft transport plan, which we published in January, so pre-COVID, which looked at really changing not just a city centre, but real creating active neighbourhoods. We're calling it places for people, where we reduce the traffic, reduce the speed of traffic in those areas, and let people dominate by walking and cycling. And then, you know, in response to COVID, COVID's created massive challenges for us as society. But one of the things we've done is taken the opportunity to build on the increase in leisure cycling during the lockdown to introduce a number of key pop-up cycle lanes over the next 8 weeks. We're really pleased that we've got £1 million off the government via the regional authority, topped up by £600,000, which we had left from other cycling projects, to deliver these 14 projects, 7 pop-up cycle lanes, low traffic neighbourhoods, park and pedal, and a number of other things. So we're quite excited moving forward, but there's the challenges, because cycling is Marmite currently in the city. You know, you'll get some people who are demanding more, which is fantastic. And then I'll get other people who are absolutely trolling me on social media, you know, that I'm anti-car and what have you. But this is about people. This is about life chances. It's about reversing health inequalities. This is going to happen. Simple as that.
We've seen across the country, and it's great to hear you know, talk like that, but we've seen other cities, other towns, other regions with less boldness, you know, pulling out pop-up cycle lanes after 48 hours, or, you know, drastically changing the town centres just on the, you know, the feedback of a couple of shopkeepers after, you know, a couple of days, which, you know, no one ever opened the M42 and gone, oh, it's not really full yet, we should probably close it. So I often think that there's this worry from local councillors of that obviously feedback from their public, people that vote for them. What do you think about that? How do you approach that? Because obviously it must be on your mind. You know, there are some vocal people in the city, but you seem to have just kind of managed to do what you're doing regardless of that, which not many local councillors in this country have done.
So out of this, there's two things. In 2018, there was a massive democratic change in Birmingham. We went to all-out elections for councillors every 4 years rather than an election every year. And when you have an election every year, one-third of your councillors have just got elected and the other third go into campaigning mode. So what the electoral feel, and as councillors, if you get 2 or 3 people writing to us, we get nervous automatically. So having that 4-year period to deliver projects enable us to make some tough decisions as year 1 and 2. And by year 4, when people go back to the people to the ballot box, we've seen the fruit of those decisions. And most importantly, the communities have seen that. And the other thing is, I think we... we really need to look at the challenges that we've got in Coltrane. And I'll give you another example. In Birmingham, I'm getting areas like Moseley, Kingsheath, Bourneville, you know, white middle-class neighbourhoods who are demanding more cycling. It's brilliant. These are quick wins, low-hanging fruit. But for me, what's more important is some of those inner-city areas, which are largely BAME-dominated, where cycling levels are incredibly low in those areas, but health inequalities are high. And we've seen the impact of COVID there. It's been, you know, huge, because there's massive issues. There's cultural issues there around how people move. And, you know, there's some houses in my ward and across inner-city Birmingham, which has got 3 cars per household, 4 cars per household. Walking, you know, doesn't exist. Cycling is absolutely not an option. So whether you're there traveling a mile or 20 miles, in those neighborhoods, it's all about private car. And we have to change that if we're going to move forward and really tackle some of the real issues that exist in our community. There has to be a cultural change. And we need ambassadors and advocates to lead that. And that's the one thing that, you know, I work very closely with the cycling groups in Birmingham and some of the environmental groups, and they're absolutely getting, and they're helping us drive this forward. Because if we are going to win the hearts and minds of our communities, it's going to be those key community advocates in our communities, rooted in our communities, who are going to help us make these changes.
I saw a video of you, actually. You talked about learning to cycle at, that was at 37. I saw a video of you on YouTube, and I was like, he can't just be learning to cycle, because you look like you'd already been doing it. It was amazing. But yeah, it turns out it's true. So yeah, it's interesting about the, you know, about cycling, like you say, being sort of traditionally white in this country, and the challenges that you have around getting more people on bikes from BAME communities. And you talked about ambassadors. Obviously, the West Midlands doesn't have a full-time cycling commissioner at the moment. Is that one of the roles that would help to get more people from BAME communities on bikes? It's going to be quite a big change, isn't it? If people are wedded to their cars, maybe they don't want to cycle.
So, Laura, for me, it's not necessarily having a West Midlands-wide ambassador, but it's having those people in the communities. And, you know, there's a couple of projects which I think have been phenomenal. There's the Saheli Women's Hub, which is led by Nasi Makhtar, and they're part of the Active Wellbeing Society now, and Big Birmingham Bikes. And she's done an incredible job with her team, because she goes into a community, and not only does she get women who've traditionally not gone beyond the local school gate by foot, get some walking, get some, you know, they've run marathons. And they've been, you know, they did the Velo a couple of years ago in the middle of Ramadan, a shorter version of the Velo on the day. But it was fantastic.
And that's where they close the streets to motor traffic through
Absolutely.
Birmingham, isn't it?
Absolutely. So, you know, miles and miles across Birmingham and the West Midlands where we closed it up. And to see 50 Muslim women, some of them wearing hijab, some of them, you know, wearing traditional clothes, out there on bikes together, supporting each other. Then what Naseem does, which is absolutely amazing, she trains them up to be ambassadors, to go out and work with women. So for me, they are the real ambassadors. And there's a group of Bangladeshi, predominantly men, who are part of Noka Bice, which is a dragon boat racing festival that happens once a year, which is an amazing event in itself. And what they've done is started to cycle initially, and then got others in their community, particularly a lot of the restaurant workers. And the last time some of them cycled was back in Bangladesh. So, you know, getting them back on the bikes has been quite an incredible journey. And now they're getting their families to cycle. But one of the clear challenges we see is, you know, it's brilliant we're putting some infrastructure in, but there are real issues about accessibility to bikes. So Big Birmingham Bikes have handed out 7,000 free bikes over the years to particularly people from, you know, who've got health challenges and socioeconomic deprived backgrounds. But we need to absolutely realize there are those challenges in families. I had a conversation the other day with somebody, one of the local youth workers was working with a group, saying somebody wants to take his daughter out on a bike, but they can't afford a bike. So what do we do there? So I think there's real issues there. And, you know, putting the infrastructure is really, really important. That safe infrastructure for people like me who've never cycled before. This isn't about people who've been cycling for years and do the Velo and stuff like that. This is safe cycling infrastructure for people who've never been on a bike. But we have also got to look at the absolutely look at the accessibility to bikes too, because that is at times a big, big barrier.
Wazim, just picking up on what you just said, a couple of things struck me actually. One is It's very fresh in my imagination now because it's just passed, but the British National Cycling Road Race Championships were supposed to be happening in Birmingham this year, but obviously they've been postponed because of COVID, and the Velo event, what's it called? The Velothon or something. I can't remember exactly what it's called, was going to be running in tandem with them in the mass participation ride. So that's just a real shame. There's nothing we can do about that. And hopefully it'll come back next year. But equally, I completely agree with you about this, this rush towards getting sort of high profile ambassadors who maybe aren't necessarily kind of too committed to the role, and the extreme importance of getting people who believe in it and who are embedded in the community. I couldn't agree more. I think it's that's much more powerful tools, sort of micro seeding people throughout the community to actually affect change on a street level, if you like, and change hearts and minds in that way. I think that's absolutely the right approach. And it just struck me that, especially talking about, I mean, I increasingly understand that the word BAME is a bit of a kind of word we should move on from, because it strikes me as a very blunt tool to describe very disparate communities. I have been doing a bit of work recently with a wonderful charity called The Bike Project. Some of their work is done in London, who provide, they provide donated bikes that they then do up, and they donate to refugee communities. Refugees, asylum seekers, people who are here who are otherwise cut adrift from funding streams or work, and need bikes, and they really need bikes. And at first I kind of wondered whether this was just a worthy project that a bunch of middle class white people were doing with no great kind of access to the people they're trying to get the bikes to. Turns out I was completely wrong. You know, the demand for Bike Project services is way, way outstrips their actual ability to supply their client group, for want of a better word. They have a waiting list of something like 700 in London, people who want their bikes. So the biggest determinant of all of this is the need, isn't it? Really, ultimately, these communities need bikes because they can't afford, even if they wanted to, they can't afford to jump on the tube in London or jump on a bus or get, let alone think of getting in a car. So it's making that kind of connection between cycling as a proposition and cycling as a solution, and getting that message out in the communities that I think you seem to be particularly kind of engaged in. Have I got that right?
Absolutely. One of the other things we've done to ensure that there's that direct connection is we've set up community cycling clubs, some of them based in local parks. And so working with the Active Wellbeing Society, we put 30-odd bikes in there with a couple of trained people from the local community. The important thing is having, you know, it's not people parachuting in from outside the neighborhood, but people in that neighborhood who have a passion for cycling. Some of them have been on a journey like I have, but you know, the key thing is they're trained up and they're able to help others. And they've got 30 odd bikes there. And I was talking to the local community cycling club in Lazelles, the one that's most local to me. Their bikes have gone, and people are using them during this period of time. That is the key thing. And through the trackers that we've got on these orange bikes, our big Birmingham bikes, the ones that we hand out, are all orange, and there's a key tracker on there. We can monitor how many miles there. I think there was something like 200,000 miles in the first quarter of this year carried out with those free bikes, 197,000. And even though there was a bit of a dip early on in March because of the uncertainty that COVID initially created. That's amazing. It's fantastic to see those bikes, but we need more. I get emails and challenged on social media all the time around those free bikes. So I'll be really, really keen to see how, you know, the West Midlands would use this extra resource that we've got from the government to ensure that we've got those bikes. Because the other problem we've had in the West Midlands is the bike share project failed. The Mayor Andy Street was very quick to get some pictures in South Lord of Wolverhampton, but it collapsed very soon after. And he needs to get that right very, very quickly. He needs to get a lot right, but things like that are very, very important to our region.
Yeah, and I spoke to Andy Street a couple of weeks ago for a Guardian article, and he said the next bike is being revitalised. They're deciding on a supplier in July, and they're hoping to roll it out starting throughout this year, so 2020. So to you, that's going to be helpful for people who don't have access.
Yeah, we
to
live
bikes.
At home, Laura. I'm not as confident as he is with that. And it's been really disappointing. And this is not me playing politics, but generally, Andy Street's approach to walking and cycling has been literally non-existent, even during this COVID period of time. And you know, you've got people like Boris Johnson, Grant Shapps making very strong national statements around walking and cycling, but yet the mayor of the West Midlands is not said much at all, and his actions are around walking and cycling since he took office have been virtually non-existent too.
This was a big piece of The Guardian that I wrote that was published recently, and because I'd heard him speaking at a conference, and he'd said that with the best will in the world, in a region like ours, you're only going to get 5% of people cycling, and the propensity to cycle tool, which is an academic analysis of how many people you can get cycling in a specific region based on the trips that people are already doing, said 39% in areas like Wolverhampton. So it did seem hugely underwhelming in terms of ambition. He told me there's no lack of desire or ambition. It's a question of how rapidly we can assemble the funding, as it was not here historically. And he said, I actually think we've done a pretty decent job. But in terms of the sort of region-wide plans, the sort of 200 kilometres compared with Manchester, which has got a huge amount more with their B network, 1,800 miles, the 620 miles in Sheffield, and Leicester's adding a mile a week during the COVID crisis to its active travel network. And so I think the feeling among people that I'd spoken to was the same was as you said. It does seem like there is a huge appetite actually in the West Midlands for cycling. I think it's got one of the highest unmet demands for cycling, according to Sustrans. They interviewed a load of people in the area who said that they would love to cycle, but most people don't feel like it's safe enough on the roads. So it does seem to have been a bit of a disappointment from that region.
Yeah, we've been at loggerheads with some of the opposition parties, pre-COVID really. You know, even when we launched the Birmingham Transport Plan, we were attacked by Conservative colleagues for being anti-car, whereas we were pro-people, because for me, improving walking and cycling measures is all about improving people's life chances and making them their health and well-being a lot stronger. And it's quite ironic that some of the things we were saying around reducing traffic and car traffic in the city centre in Birmingham, which they attacked, is something that the government is now encouraging as a post-COVID opportunity that most towns and cities need to take up. But I just think that the level of ambition that we've had in the region for cycling over many years, and this is not just about Andy Street, it's just been generally, it's not been taken seriously and it's not been seen as a real option. But whereas now people are absolutely excited about walking cycling, we've got the e-scooters trial, where, you know, I think that's going to be a major game changer in our efforts to tackle congestion and improve air quality within this city too. So there's a lot of positives, and I know there's the phenomenon of e-bikes that's growing too. And I see e-scooters and e-bikes as a journey to push bikes for certain communities, in particular those who are reluctant to make the change from private car to a normal bike initially. But we're not going to be popular. Not everyone's going to agree with what we've got to do, especially when you take road space away from private car. But we have to do it. And for me, we will only get the change from the modal shift in certain sections when they do see themselves stuck in traffic in Birmingham, spending hours and hours behind a steering wheel. And yet you've got public transport, you know, getting bus priority. You get cyclists getting their own space, and people, you know, ultimately could, in some areas, could walk faster than people, you know, cars can travel in certain areas. So I think ultimately we will get the shift then, but we have to be brave. And for me, COVID's created that opportunity and has been a catalyst on this journey. So, you know, Birmingham's aspiration for, I think, 5% by of journeys by 2023 and 10% by 2033. I think we can fast forward that by 10 years. I think 10% by 2023 and 20% by 2033 is something that we really need to be looking to do. And it's not just going to be segregated cycle lanes, but it's, you know, things like low traffic neighborhoods. I think that in communities, in neighborhoods, that will be massive. We did put in for the a submission into government to become a 20 mile per hour default city, because 90% of the roads in Birmingham are residential roads. So it'd have been a lot cheaper for us to go down the route of becoming a blanket 20 mile per hour city and just put the repeater signs on 10% of the roads. It's economically a lot more viable. But the government's come back and said continue doing the rollout of 20 mile per hour zones. So what they're saying to me is continue paying loads and loads of money to do all these little neighborhoods. Ultimately, we could still become a 90% 20 mile per hour city through those smaller neighborhoods, but it'll just take a lot longer and cost a lot more money. So I'm quite disappointed with the government's response. But I've heard that Wales are, as a regional government, are looking at this very, very carefully. So let's see what comes about that.
I think just on the politics side, it's obviously for people that don't know in the region, obviously West Midlands is largely, other than just a couple of local authorities, is largely Labour, and obviously Andy Street is a Conservative mayor. I think my view, working in working in Coventry as bicycle mayor, is that can both lend itself to opportunities, but also has its issues in terms of collaboration. So I think one thing we have got in having a Conservative mayor is we have seen that the national body, the national kind of narrative from central government is becoming quite pro-cycling, as you say, with Grant Shapps being quite bold and obviously stuff coming from Boris Johnson. One thing that I think, politics aside though, that really frustrates me, and we've got in common, I'm in Coventry, you're in Birmingham, we're motor cities, we seem to not quite be able to move away politically, certainly in Coventry, even as in Labour, and from Andy Street. We can't move away from the car industry. I'm not talking about car usage, but private car manufacturer. And in Coventry especially, we're obsessed with electrification. So, we think that by making all our cars e-cars and all our traffic jams e-traffic jams, that somehow we're going to solve all of our issues. And, I can see that that's not going to be the case. And I know that when you launched your plan, there was some opposition discussions on, almost a war on the motor industry. What do you, what do we think, Oseem, on that topic? Can the Midlands ever shake off this motor city kind of label? And is the power, we know that the car lobby has an incredible amount of power and employment power. I think it's something like 2% of all jobs in the West Midlands, I believe. So, how do we get past that, and how do we start to encourage people to look outside this kind of the way it's always been done, the status quo that hasn't worked for us particularly well since the 1960s and 70s?
So I think shifting 10 or 20% of the journeys from private car to cycling is not going to make a dent on the motor industry. I think that's a false economy as far as I'm concerned. I think the real thing here is, so for us in Birmingham, a quarter of the journeys on any normal day of a mile long are by car. So we get 300,000 daily journeys in Birmingham, less than 1 mile by car. And it's how we can shift those journeys. So these are to the local school, to the local high street, to the go see your friend around the corner, go to a local coffee shop, go to the library. It just doesn't make sense. So it's how we can shift those journeys from private car to walking and cycling. And I think we've seen some real brave political leadership in some cities. And the Paris mayor election most recently, where her principal political commitment, number one thing on her manifesto was creating 15-minute cities within Paris to get people more walking and cycling. And that for me again was phenomenal. And that there's been a clear political shift in what people are saying. And I'm very hopeful that our mayoral candidate, Liam Byrne, who absolutely gets the importance of walking and cycling, absolutely gets the importance of protecting the motor industry and protecting those jobs. But for me, there's no conflict there. It's putting some cycle lanes and a pop-up lanes to help people walk and cycle is not going to, we're not going to end up losing hundreds and hundreds of jobs in the motor industry. There's been other challenges in the motor industry, and in particular, the developments and the competition we've had from other countries when it comes to the motor industry, which have a bigger dent on our challenges in the West Midlands. But I think with strong political will, and sometimes, you know, we need to take the communities on a journey with us. We need to work with them. But when they start to see some of the results in some neighbourhoods, I think there'll be greater demand for more and more change in our city and across our region too.
So you've got 1.6 million to spend on this emergency transport plan. You announced in the mid-May that you were going to be doing a load of stuff, including pop-up cycleways, park and pedal, low-traffic neighbourhoods, pavement widening, et cetera, et cetera. I'm wondering how far you've got so far and what the timescale is for these plans.
So, Laura, we've literally just had the announcement from government. They'll give us £1 million, and we'll top that up with another 600,000. So we've got 8 weeks to deliver that. And we will deliver that in the 6 weeks. This is tranche one. And at the same time, we'll start working on tranche two projects. And for me, by September, when hopefully schools, colleges and universities and most people are back to work, we will have further projects. I'm very, very excited with what we've got. And ultimately, these are temporary measures, but I'd like to see most, if not all of these, become permanent measures moving forward. So it's exciting. And, you know, as long as we get the resource to make these changes, we've got a clean air zone coming next year. And we know that there'll be quite a considerable amount of resource generated from that, which will have to be reinvested into improving air quality and improving how people move across our city. I will invest a lot of that money into walking and cycling measures too. So we're absolutely hell-bent on ensuring that we've got a fit-for-purpose infrastructure. But just to repeat what I said earlier, we also need to ensure that we've got bikes. And one of the commitments that our leaders made in terms of the Commonwealth Games coming in 2022, a legacy for us will be every child in Birmingham has access to a bike. And that's a sort of legacy that we want from such an amazing opportunity, which is the Commonwealth Games. So we're on a real, real journey where we're willing to make these bold and brave decisions because they're the right decisions. They're the decisions that will get more people walking, get more people cycling. We think we'll save massive amount of money in the long term from our NHS expenditure in the city. So it'll be well worth it. And people will live longer. People will live healthier. So the benefits are hugely outweigh the challenges that we're currently facing.
Listen, Wasim, I can tell how committed you are to this and how passionate you are about it. You're a tremendous ally to have in Birmingham Council, and I wish you more power to your arm, because I don't think there's anything that you said throughout that entire interview that I didn't wholeheartedly agree with. My fervent hope is that I can renew my two-wheeled acquaintance with your city at the soonest possible opportunity when this lockdown eases and I can get back to the real world. And the real world in your case is Birmingham. So good luck effecting that. And let's hope that, mate, even if 50% of what you've hoped for comes to fruition, then it's going to be a revolutionary change. Thanks very much, Wasim. And thanks for contributing to our podcast.
Thanks, Ned, Adam and Laura. Thank you all for having me on. Cheers.
So, that was a welcome break from our metropolitan bubble, wasn't it, Laura, to which you and I are wholeheartedly signed up members and Adam isn't. But it's really interesting what he had to say. I know that Wasim was also very keen, Adam, to talk about canals, and we didn't give him time to talk about canals because famously Birmingham has more canals than the moon and Venice combined or something like that. There's some statistic like that, isn't there? But I mean, so there are a bunch of canals and they are a bit underutilized as well. So I know that was on his agenda as well.
Yes. Yeah. He didn't get a chance to mention, but he quickly mentioned afterwards that Birmingham is looking at a kind of a joined up integrated approach at the canal network. And this, in my view, and I know in Laura's view as well, can't come soon enough. There is a worrying kind of status quo in the Midlands that because we have these canal networks, we have cycling infrastructure. When I recommended to Coventry Council that they create a key worker corridor to the local hospital, they pointed out that it was a nice meandering river route that went to the hospital that people could use. And for me, that's not good enough. And I think from Laura's article in The Guardian that was, excellent for the West Midlands, the thing that really stuck out for me is, Andy Street talking about canals, standing in front of canals, talking about cycling, and the very same day as talking to Laura, two women were pushed off their bikes into canals in Birmingham. So it's very clear that canals aren't safe cycling infrastructure. Yes, they serve a purpose, and I cycle on canals, and you know, in some places it's a very nice leisure activity. And if you've got a very specific commute, it might do okay for you. But we shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking that canals are genuine cycling infrastructure, because they're not lit, they don't have CCTV, they're not good surfaces. And there's a massive, you know, instead of being close past, you're being literally close past by water wherever you go, which isn't that much fun.
Yeah, it's a hopeless misunderstanding of what cycling is, isn't it? To think that you can share pedestrian spaces and cycling along canal towpaths. I mean, it's self-evidently a nonsense. The only time I can, in my lived experience, that I actually think canals and cycling really work fantastically well is on the Surrey Canal, which runs through from central London down towards Peckham and southeast London. But that has the massive advantage of being filled in with earth. It's no longer a canal. It's no longer a canal. I mean, I don't know when it was filled in, but there's a strip, you can look at it on the map. There's a strip of green cycleway and pedestrian way that is canal width, but has no water, which is a huge advantage.
I mean, that is an opportunity for us if we, you know, I think we're going to get some people writing in on this, but perhaps
bring it on.
Perhaps we could just fill in the entire canal network.
It's bad news. It's bad news for whole season's holidays. I suspect.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons that they haven't lit the canals in Birmingham actually is because it's part of the industrial heritage. And I think some people are arguing, as so Andy Street hinted when we chatted, that some people are arguing that they shouldn't be lit presumably because they're part of the industrial heritage. But yeah, it was, that whole week was quite bizarre because he started off, you know, it started off with, you know, a summer of walking and cycling. And you look at, he's just standing on this canal, and then you think, imagine that at night. There's like massive tall build there, like broken windows, tall abandoned looking buildings, graffiti. And then it apparently goes nowhere. There's like some bridges and it looks like you'd have to get off and duck to get under it. I'm not sure. Maybe there's some stairs that you'd have to hoik your bike up. But yeah, terrifying. And then he's like, come and cycle, you know, come to Birmingham, come and cycle the canal network. And then literally that evening, a load of women got pushed in. It is terrifying. I was cycling on some canals at the weekend, kind of by accident. I plotted a route, ended up on this bloody canal near me. And it was awful. It was so narrow. It's just not a commuter route. And like you said, Ned, it's just a fundamental misunderstanding of what cycling is. And I think represents perhaps the attitude from the leadership in the West Midlands, where, you know, if you don't cycle, you don't understand cycling as a commuter thing. You think, oh, well, cycling's a holiday thing. You can go on the canals. It's fine.
Laura, I put out to Twitter just before we started recording, you know, anything that anyone wants to raise on this podcast. So a little bit of feedback. I don't know if I'll be able to sort of raise all the issues that came my way, but somebody called Chris Nicholson in Aberdeen, I think, made a wonderfully clear point that had never occurred to me before, that chimes with what you've just said, in that people in policymaking positions confuse cycling as a replacement for walking, but not as a replacement for driving. So in terms of distance and speed. And that's so true, isn't it? I think that's very true, because that's why we end up with all this, you know, infrastructure that requires you to kind of stop every 30 yards and wait and slow down and all that sort of thing. So I think it's a really very good point, and I hadn't considered that before.
Yeah, really good point. So what do we think about, obviously, Councillor Zaffa talks a good game on cycling. What do we think his chances of delivering in Birmingham would be good to see, wouldn't it? I guess proof will be in what he manages to roll out between now and September.
I think the proof is in, you know, proof is always in the pudding with these things. But I do have a certain amount of, you know, very, I think, well-placed hope in what Birmingham can achieve, because of the reasons Wasim mentioned early on in his interview about the political will, and also very simply, which not a lot of people consider, the four-year term. And we have an issue in lots of cities and lots of county towns and things like that, where you're seeing councillors just kind of like losing their nerve and you know, doing the right thing and then sort of having to track back on based on like aggro from people in cars. And I think the really important thing you need is people that have got a good control of their brief. Waseem clearly, you know, is very well read on the topic, you know, new to it. And I think that's the brilliant thing. I always think one of the best opportunities is to get, you know, councillors on bikes and show them what it's like. And he's obviously taken it upon himself to do that. And once you see this stuff, you can't unsee it. And obviously, similar to, I guess, Boris Johnson is rumoured to have, you know, his sort of cycling focus has come from the fact that he believed that his obesity was linked to a higher susceptibility to COVID. So, you know, I think having that personal experience is really great, and having that leadership. What I find in some places, the person who has, you know, where I am in Coventry, but also in Warwickshire and many other towns and cities and county councils, the transport dude is normally a dude. It's just the kind of person who has the role and really doesn't have any, you know, any kind of interest in it at all. And you can see their faces when you ask them a question or someone comes in and says, "Oh, this is like one of the hardest briefs because just everyone hates me." I think that we're seeing clearly is in control of his brief, and we've seen it in Hackney, haven't we? And we've seen it in Leicester with the deputy mayor who we had on the podcast. Very clearly got vision and a 4-year term to deliver that vision, and wants to be judged not on the amount of emails they received that week, but by their legacy that they leave in the fourth year. And evidence shows, I think, in Waltham Forest, it shows in Paris, if you are kind of unwaveringly bold and say this is what we can do, and you deliver something, then people will go and vote with their feet. That seems like a good thing if we've got that kind of leadership and long-term view, which we have in Birmingham, but seemingly not in other parts of the Midlands, and unfortunately not in parts of the country.
Anne Hidalgo is the name of the mayor of Paris. We've referenced her a couple of times. She probably needs name-checking because she's obviously a force for good. One thing I've been wanting to say for a few days since we recorded about a lot of cars, right? Because that is the lived experience of people right now. There are a lot of cars on our roads. There are probably more cars on our roads. That's what it feels like, than there were before COVID. But I think there's in our, if you like, in our community, people who are engaged with this subject matter, there's quite a lot of hand-wringing about, it's all failed. You know, it was all for nothing. It's all gone bad. It's all gone rotten much quicker than we thought it would have done. Adam, I have to credit you with being, you know, very early on when we started doing this podcast, you said there is a big risk when lockdown comes to an end that people will just get straight in their cars. And I didn't really see what you meant, but turns out you were right. People really do see the car as a solution in the times that we're living in, especially in London. So that's a bad bit. What I would like to say in terms of kind of raising morale is that just because there are a lot of cars and there are a lot of people using cars, I actually think there are a lot of people using bikes and a lot of people walking as well. It's just that no one is on the tube and no one is on the train and no one is on the buses, and all those millions of people who otherwise would be using those modes aren't. So some of them have gone to their motor vehicles, but a lot of them haven't. I genuinely think that, you know, it's not an either or.
Yeah.
It's both.
Yeah. And I think we remember clearly having those lovely quiet roads, and polls have been saying most people don't want to go back to the way things were before. And now that cars have come back, it just seems so jarring and loud, and it feels kind of offensive on your senses. And I'm sure I'm not the only one that's experienced that. And like you say, a lot of people still out on their bikes, despite the conditions.
The demand for new bikes, the demand for bike parts, the demand for bike repair services is has not relented. You know, it really hasn't. It's as tough as it ever was. If going back a few weeks, I was just talking to, here we go, Mark from down the road again, Lady Watt Cycles, who I keep plugging. But he's telling me that, hey, that inner tubes, he has to sell them now at three times what he was selling them before COVID because the supply chains are dried up. They are massively more expensive than they were because the demand is so great. So get our puncture repair kits out and get old school, and that's the way. So what I'm trying to say is it is still there. You know, I don't think we should throw our arms up in despair and say that the experiment has failed.
No, like it's on a knife edge. And I think Chris Boardman said it a couple of weeks ago in the media that, you know, what happens now is really going to shape the future. And I, you talked about cars being a solution, or people feeling like they're a solution at least. And that's sort of fine. I think the conversely, the conversation we need to have, which is a very difficult conversation to have, is that cars are also a problem. There is, on an individual basis, there isn't a, you know, there isn't an understanding of take, you know, Wasim saying 300,000 daily journeys are taken under 1 mile. And yeah, I'm not anti car, but like making cars for short journeys is it has to be seen as something that affects other people rather than just, you know, just being something that you do. And also we've got to provide people with better alternatives. And that's the frustration I've had is we had this once in a lifetime opportunity, and we still, you know, we still got the claws of that that we potentially could still savior in some cities to do something different and to reallocate. And the key is reallocate road space. And what we've ended up with is instances where that has been done for a matter of days. And you know, that argument of the kind of bike lash of, oh, this has caused terrible congestion, so what we should do is find a way to not give people any alternatives and just give a little bit more space for cars that will get filled up more. It just doesn't make any sense in any kind of long-term vision. And we're just, you know, that needs to change. We need to get some sort of boldness through. And the government talked about taking on, they've been quite bold, you know, they've given some councils only 50% of the money they've asked for. And I think soon they will potentially name and shame them in a list. And I think that they have talked about being bolder than that. And actually with the statutory guidance, almost taking control of councils that don't comply, taking control of the transport teams to make sure they do what they need to do. And there hasn't been any kind of, you know, consequence for councils that have not done anything or not done very much yet. And I think that needs to be a change of the status quo from a governmental point of view to change the status quo on our streets as well.
I think it's very early days still. And I know in London, stuff has been tweaked as councils have come back with plans that are not so good. And I would imagine that that's going to happen on a national level as well. That's why they've got two phases. So the first phase for the emergency stuff is going to be, you know, deliver stuff quickly. If councils don't do that, they can reallocate the second phase on. And I think that sort of carrot and stick could be quite powerful potentially. We've also still, you know, you talked about the cars being back, you know, there's also the very real chance, or almost inevitability now, of a second wave in which we'll have further lockdowns. So the situation of no cars is going to be one that we'll see again, unfortunately, you know, given the reasons for that. But I think the health argument that Wasim was talking to is very powerful in this crisis and also in the long term. And I think it's important that that's where he's coming from a personal perspective, as well as, you know, politically, that's what he's talking to. But I guess it will be in delivery. And he said himself, council's talking big talk on cycling. And I'm hoping that they can.
It is a long-term thing, Laura, and I do appreciate that. I think for anyone who's read the Steve Peters book, The Chimp Paradox, my chimp often thinks that, you know, this has to be done overnight. And, you know, my raw emotion is definitely like, we're losing. And our car dominance has been built up over a series of decades, which is worth remembering. But I would say that there in order to grab the narrative and make some bold changes, there is an element of urgency. And I'm not, they're obviously different crises, but looking at the Netherlands and the Stop the Kindermord movement, that was very powerful, very bold, very quick, and very continued. And that was the catalyst for change. And I think we need to very quickly make sure our political leadership follow through with the kind of words that they've used so far with deeds, because I think with local, you know, so much of this is reliant on local councils, and Wasim, who we spoke to, is a great example of that being in a positive light from a kind of cycling point of view. But there are so many, the vast majority of local councils are very apathetic towards cycling. So if you don't get them now and shake them, there's a very good chance that they will just go back to what they've always done.
A bit of good news on the active travel front. This week in Manchester, the UK's first Cyclops Junction is opening, which is like a Dutch style crossroads, picture it, parallel cycling and walking lanes around the outside. But instead of where the Dutch have the pedestrians on the outside of this parallel, they've switched it so that pedestrians are on the inside. And by doing so, have made the crossing times shorter because there's less space to cross, and have given time back to cars. And I don't know if you know that in the UK, basically how we calculate the business case for road construction is how much time does it give to drivers or take away from drivers? And if it takes time away from drivers, it's like computer says no. And I was talking to Chris's technical advisor. He was saying you've got like a 2-year battle on your hands at that stage. By switching them round and giving the time back to cars, it's basically like an automatic yes. You save all that time. This is his theory. And so he reckons we can start rolling these out. They're doing them like 20 in Manchester. They've got like 60 in the pipelines. And he reckons it's like an easy win for junctions, obviously junctions like where most collisions happen. So he seemed very positive and excited about that. And from talking to him, I don't know, I feel excited about it too.
That is such a Chris Boardman and Brian Deegan thing, isn't it? Like, assess the system, assess the status quo, then find something that both not only wins but also, you know, follows the system that you don't really like that much, and deliver a solution that works for everybody. I mean, that is such a great thing.
Yeah, kind of work within those parameters. It wasn't them that came up with it. I think Brian went to some of the engineering people and said, "We have to make this work. Make it work." And they were like, "Oh, well, if we switch this around," and he's like, "Why didn't we think of this 15 years ago?" But yeah, it seems very exciting. There's another one coming out in Bolton. They're doing them as part of bus schemes now because they're actually improving journey times for buses. They can do them as part of congestion busting programs. So that means you can apply for funding from congestion funds, from like growth funds, where you couldn't before for cycling. So sounds super exciting to me. If it works, as they say, it will.
I think we should do a bit more talking about walking at some point. I think we focus rightly, because it's our passion. I think all three of us on cycling, and you know, I think maybe we need to. I was so struck, Adam, as you rightly said, by what Wasim said about 300,000 journeys of under a mile. That's not a cycling distance, is it? That's a walking distance, and there's nothing more accessible than walking for people who can. I mean, there is literally shoe leather, isn't it? So, thanks for giving us a bit of a positive spin there, Laura. That was very needed. I can't get my head around the Cyclops Junction. I'm going to have to Google that, because it sounds...
Yeah, it's hard to describe, really. I mean, maybe I didn't describe it very well, but anyway, there's pictures. Maybe we can share a picture somewhere on the...
We'll share a picture in the show notes or something. Yeah. Let's do that. And yeah, I totally agree, Ned. Like, walking is a superpower, as people say. So definitely let's do more of that.
Yep, all right. Adam, thank you very much for getting us out of our metropolitan bubble, if only for a brief visit up to the West Midlands. Thank you very much, Laura, for keeping us all motivated and telling us about the Cyclops. Thank you to Wasim for his excellent contribution. Thanks to you listening at home to our 9th edition. So next time we record, we're going to be double digits and we will come of age. Do keep listening, please. And obviously rate us as well on all the various ratings things, because it helps us feel good about ourselves. miles. And that's what it's all about. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you again next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.